Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the History of Africa podcast. I'm your host, Andy. In our last episode, we examined the transition from the nomadic herding of the prehistoric Sahara to the rise of settled agriculture, the origins of the earliest Garamantian settlements, and the complex system of irrigation that allowed the people of the Wadi al-Ajel to transform one of the driest regions on Earth into a series of fertile gardens. Settlements turned to cities, with the remaining pastoral nomads traveling between these fertile sites to graze their herds and trade wares. This early form of trade across the Sahara, though, would soon become one of the defining features of the Garamantian state, the backbone of its economy. Season 5, Episode 3, Trans-Saharan Trade in the Garamantese Civilization. In the very first episode I made of this podcast, in which I introduce some basic geographic context about the African continent, there is one particular section which I have since come to disagree with strongly. Take it away, past me. This massive desert limited contact between the people on each side of the Sahara, meaning that cultures north of the Sahara were influenced very little by the cultures south of the Sahara, and vice versa. Of course, this doesn't mean that trans-Saharan contact and influences never happened, and we'll talk about several notable examples of this kind of contact throughout the series. But just keep in mind that these events are exceptional. Aw, listen to that ignorant fool with his terrible microphone. What past me was claiming was something that I have since come to strongly object to, the division of Africa into a strict binary of North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa. Now, to be fair to that guy, he did try to couch the claim with the weaselly reference to some vague idea of contact taking place at times. And also, to be fair to that guy, I was far from the only person making this mistake. Plenty of people, even many accredited and respected historians, can make the error of assuming that trans-Saharan contact was much more minor than it actually was. However, this is a pretty major misrepresentation. In that past clip, I dramatically undersold the significance and scale of trans-Saharan contact throughout North and West African history, especially regarding the medieval and early modern periods. In that time, trade and contact between the two regions had become remarkably common, with the vast ocean of sands of the Sahara being only a road bump along the way, certainly a geographic obstacle, but not one which couldn't be easily overcome with some effort. Multiple empires even outright conquered territory on the other side of the Sahara, with Morocco extending its influence and territory deep into the Sahel during the early modern period, and earlier the West African Kanem Empire extending its control over North African towns like Zawila. But even among the historians who do recognize the importance and scale of trans-Saharan contact, this contact is still often misunderstood as solely a product of the Islamic era, and therefore assume that trade and broader contact between Northern and West Africa remained essentially non-existent until the spread of Islam and Arab culture into North Africa in the medieval period. Today, we will look at some examples of archaeology from the Garamantian period, which either undermine, or in some cases, can outright disprove this idea, suggesting that while yes, contact was quite limited compared to the heights that it would reach in the medieval period, that there definitely was at least some degree of commercial contact between North and West Africa, even at this very early ancient time. And of course, the Garamantes were happy to act as middlemen on this lucrative early trade route. Prior to the rise of concentrated agricultural settlements like Zinkekra, the archaeological record provides little information about the state of Saharan trade. There is some evidence of trade between the people of Fezzan and ancient Egypt, namely from rock art from the time period of around 2000 BC and later. It is during this time period, at first predating and then coinciding with the rise of Zinkekra and later Germa as major settlements, that a curious artifact proliferates throughout Saharan rock art, the chariot. In many different regions of the Sahara, including Fezzan, chariots became a remarkably common motif. Now, chariots were used extensively in warfare in multiple North African states, including the Egyptians, as well as their neighbors, the coastal Libyans and Nubian peoples. It is almost certain, then, that the chariots were introduced to the people of the Sahara through contact with one or more of these nations, and that this contact was more than likely commercial in nature. Now, whether or not this means Saharans rode their own chariots at this time, or whether they were simply depicting memories of chariots they saw in foreign lands, or the chariots that foreign people rode into their lands, it still serves as strong evidence for contact. In the Sahara, these chariots were pulled by a selection of beasts of burden, ranging from donkeys to cattle to, interestingly, horses. Now, unlike with chariots, where there's still a bit of ambiguity about why they appear in rock art, we can be pretty sure that at least some domesticated horses lived in settlements in the Sahara. Now, horses, owing to their anatomy, are clearly incapable of surviving in the desert long enough as wild animals to be independently tamed. While we also know that Egypt, Nubia, and regions of the coastal Maghreb all possessed commercial horse breeding industries around this time. Now, keep in mind that in this ancient time period, the Sahara was completely camel-free. They had not yet been introduced to the region. Camels are actually not native to the Sahara, and we will talk about it in more detail about how they got introduced in a further episode. But for now, just take camels out of your mind entirely. They simply don't live in the Sahara yet. This meant that horses were, by a wide margin, the fastest and most efficient means of transportation through the desert, and were a valuable commodity that the Saharans would have certainly been willing to trade a lot for. The assumed trade for horses is likely the earliest concrete example of widespread trade between the people of the Sahara and societies in North Africa that we have. Trade with people south of the Sahara, though, is a little harder to establish, but can be detected through close analysis of the region's pottery. As you may remember, the pottery of the early Garamantes resembled the older styles of the Western Sahel far more than they did those in North Africa. This innovative form of pottery likely originated from contact between the Fezzan and Western Sahel. Similarly, and arguably even more concretely, ostriches too can be seen in some early Garamantian sites, despite the fact that by this point ostriches no longer lived in the Sahara, indicating that they most likely were obtained through trade with people who lived on its southern fringes. The scale and importance of international trade in the Fezzan increased as the Garamantian state rose. In fact, some historians have argued that alongside the need to raise labor for irrigation projects, that the existence of the Garamantian site may have been facilitated due to Sinkekra's greater control over trade routes. Due to its long history as a nomadic shelter and its safe position at the top of a hill, the city became a uniquely significant center of trade in Fezzan. In fact, the creation of a Garamantian state may have originated as a system of loosely interconnected city-states, with Sinkekra utilizing its relationship with early nomadic traders to cement its power over its neighbors. As Sinkekra's power waned and instead the capital of the kingdom shifted to Germa, the new capital took Sinkekra's place not only as the main population center, but as the primary trading hub as well. However, while certainly an interesting and plausible hypothesis, there is simply no written or archaeological evidence to support a causal link between the city's mercantile power and their rise of their respective political power. It's totally possible, but well, like much of the Garamantes' history, it's basically just educated speculation at the end of the day. Of course, alongside the settled population within the cities, nomadic herdsmen continued to cross the Sahara throughout the Garamantian period. As we discussed in our last episode, these nomads, experienced in desert crossings, were the earliest form of merchants in the region, hauling valuable goods to resell for a profit as a side hustle during their migrations. There's not a whole lot of evidence that shows that any of these nomads had fully shifted their lifestyle to become full-time merchants yet, but by at least the 5th century BC, it was clear that trade was becoming an ever more integral part of the Fezzani economy. One resource which the Garamantes almost certainly traded in was human beings, with the kingdom becoming notable throughout North Africa as a major capturer and seller of enslaved workers. This association appears in the oldest written source we have mentioning the Garamantes, a Greek historical text by the ancient writer Herodotus. You might have heard of him before. He's a pretty big deal. Writing in the 5th century BC, Herodotus states, quote, "These Garamantes go in their four horse chariots, chasing the cave-dwelling Ethiopians. For the Ethiopian cave-dwellers are swifter on foot than any men of whom tales are brought to us. They live on snakes and lizards and such like creeping things. Their speech is like no other in the world. It is like the squeaking of bats." Now, if you're a little bit geographically confused about his mention of Ethiopians, when, well, Ethiopia is not particularly close to the Fezzan, keep in mind that Herodotus, like all ancient sources, is not describing the region of modern-day Ethiopia. Rather, in ancient Greek texts, the term Ethiopians was a catch-all term for the dark-skinned peoples of Africa. The people he references the Garamantes attacking are most likely hunter-gatherers from the Tibesti Mountains of northern Chad. The region is one of the most climatically forgiving parts of the Sahara, and there is some strong archaeological evidence confirming that, indeed, the area remained one of the last refuges of hunter-gatherers in the Sahara long after the introduction of agriculture and herding to the rest of the region. But we know that these weren't the only people the Garamantes enslaved. The ancient people of Tassili Niger, located in modern Algeria, created numerous elements of rock art that showcased people riding horses, usually riding them to hunt animals. However, in a few pieces of rock art, they replace these people riding ordinary horses with instead people on multi-horse chariots. And whenever these people on chariots appear, there are no animals in sight, and they instead appear to be running directly at groups of terrified people. While again, it's hard to say for certain, this seems quite likely to be a depiction by the people of southern Algeria of a terrifying sight, a Garamantian slave raider on one of their chariots. The procurement of enslaved workers for the Garamantians was likely done with the aim of exploiting their labor on agricultural projects. Remember, last episode we invoked the sheer amount of labor that would be required to maintain the Fulgaras. Yeah, it seems likely that not all of that labor was done willingly. Of course, this was far from unusual, and slavery was a more than ubiquitous practice around the world at this ancient point in history. It's also widely assumed that the Garamantes sold the people they enslaved to others, notably Carthage, though the evidence for this is actually quite scant the further you look into this. The main piece of evidence for the trade comes from remains uncovered in Carthage, which some archaeologists have claimed represented a black African skull. Apart from the dubiousness of the idea that people can reliably identify modern racial conceptions in human skeletons, an idea I've criticized in previous episodes, check out our Bantu expansion episodes for that, the presence of Africans from south of the Sahara in Carthage on its own does not prove the existence of a trans-Saharan slave trade. This assumption is the remnant of a quite, frankly, racist association with dark skin and slavery, a cultural association born from early modern Europe, one which would have been entirely foreign to the Garamantes, Carthaginians, and everyone else on Earth at the time. If, say, the ancient remains of a person of presumed European ancestry was discovered in North Africa, I think people would speculate at least several other potential reasons for them being there before assuming that they must have been enslaved. It's quite a frustrating double standard. People find evidence for a dark-skinned African person living in Carthage, and they just assume how else would they would have gotten there if not for slavery. That's not to say that there wasn't a trans-Saharan slave trade and enslaved workers at this time. It's totally plausible, and I'd say even likely. I'm just saying we don't have much evidence to support such a system emerging at such an early period. In fact, while there's not evidence for it at this time, we do know that in later periods, the Garamantes would raid northern coastal Africa too, and take hostages as slaves there, indicating that any system of slave-taking and trading in the region was not a simple and consistent flow of captured enslaved workers from the south heading further north, but a more complex and opportunistic system of raiding. There is very strong literary and archaeological evidence that the Garamantes were a major source of a particular precious gemstone, referred to in later Roman sources as carbuncle, and more widely known today as a type of garnet. According to these sources, the Garamantes received their garnet from regions to their south and west, purchasing it from traders from the modern country of Mali, and selling it north to the markets of the Mediterranean coast. Carthage also relied on the Garamantes as a source for West African gold. The Carthaginians were well aware that the region had abundant gold mines, and later textual sources claim that the Carthaginians often bought their gold from traders in the desert, which likely is referring to the Garamantes. In fact, the desire to cut out these overland middlemen and trade directly for West African gold likely played a role in motivating perhaps the most famous single maritime expedition in African history. This is, of course, when the Carthaginian nobleman Hanno led an expedition through the Straits of Gibraltar and down the Atlantic coast, making contact perhaps as far afield as modern Nigeria, Cameroon, or even the Congo. If you'd like to learn more about North Africa's most famous explorer and the heavily disputed accounts of his expedition, then you can hear more about it on our newest premium episode, which will focus on the tale of Hanno the Navigator. And to those already supporting the show on Patreon, a heartfelt thank you. Trade across the Sahara continued to expand throughout the 6th and 5th centuries BC, especially following the establishment of one of North Africa's largest overland and maritime shipping hubs, the city of Leptis Megale. Leptis Megale originated as a Phoenician settlement on the coast of Libya, and soon became a territory of the similarly Phoenician Carthaginian Empire, the hegemon of ancient North Africa. As part of Carthage's expansive territories, Leptis Megale became a major point of connection between the Carthaginians and the Garamantes, with Garamantian nomadic merchants taking a 10-day journey from Garama to Leptis, selling numerous valuable wares. Besides the major products of garnet and gold, some other wares that were sold in Leptis included ivory, both from elephants and hippos, ebony wood, African food crops and millet, cotton, dates, ostrich eggs, salt, colorful beads, and more. We also know that the Garamantes traded for these West African resources for their own personal consumption as well. Particularly, West African crops quickly became some of the main food sources grown in the Garamantian realm. Those fugaras in the Wadi al-Ajal, well, the water from them was mostly being used to water West African sorghum and millet, two crops that were treasured due to their high salt tolerance, an absolutely crucial trait to have in the salty soil of the Sahara, which made it the superior carbohydrate crop in that environment. Soon, West African crops dramatically surpassed the previously dominant Egyptian-derived grains grown in the Fezzan. Upon selling their products, Garamantian merchants would then return to the Garamantian kingdom, and from North Africa, they would return with numerous products, including textiles, pottery, glass, olive oil, fish, and iron. Strangely enough, there is remarkably little evidence that these objects ever went beyond Garama into West Africa. Rather, it seems like most of the things that the Garamantes imported from their north were for their own domestic use. Apart from a singular find of Roman pottery shards and a small stash of Roman coinage found at an excavation in Mali in 1955, likely stemming from a later period anyways, no other evidence has yet emerged. It's certainly possible that the Garamantes were more active in facilitating trans-Saharan trade between the Carthaginians, Romans, and West Africans than we realize, but due to the largely untapped nature of antique West African archaeology, we simply don't know yet. As of right now, though, well, that's just it. We don't really know. As for what the Garamantes did trade to acquire goods from West Africa, it's also hard to say. Again, sadly, West Africa as a whole has received dramatically less archaeological attention than it needs, so excavations are quite limited, while written sources at the time are rare to non-existent. However, we can make some educated guesses based on commonly traded objects from later periods in history. On the outskirts of Wadi al-Ajal lays one of the few major copper mines in North or West Africa, a resource which was, throughout the region's ancient and medieval history, far more scarce and far more precious than gold to West Africans. Salt was also a highly valued commodity, one which the Garamantes had in abundance, but which West Africa lacked severely. Salt was especially important in coastal West Africa, where the mineral was absolutely essential in preserving food in the warm and humid climate. Throughout the centuries, the emergence of international trade allowed the lives of the Garamantes to become more prosperous. From imported fish and crops, their diets became more nutritious and plentiful. They gained access to higher quality imported ceramics and animal products. Meanwhile, the exploitation of enslaved workers that they'd captured from their neighbors allowed for unprecedented expansion of their irrigation system, with deeper fugaras giving an ever greater hydraulic supply. However, before the Garamantes reach their zenith, they will have to deal with an emerging challenge. In the year 146 BC, the unthinkable happened. The Carthaginian Empire, the ancient superpower of North Africa that the Garamantes had known for centuries, the most important commercial center in the Mediterranean, fell to an invading army. Carthage was conquered, and absorbed into a new emerging transcontinental superpower. This new hegemon of the Mediterranean would transform life everywhere they went, and for the Garamantes, well, it was no different. Join us in our next episode, as the Garamantes meet their new northern neighbors, the Roman Empire, a state which would vary between their closest partner to their most deadly threat. Thank you for listening to the History of Africa podcast. If you like our show, then we would greatly appreciate if you could help support the show and our project of freely available online history education. You can do this by supporting us at patreon.com/historyofafrica, providing us a rating or review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or iTunes, or by sharing the podcast with anyone who you think might enjoy learning about African history. This episode is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, including Naomi Kanakia, Iofag Bamie, Dimitri, Alexander Travis, BB Milliam, Conrad Schwenke, Johnny Knowles, Godfrey Sebelabie, Pascalum Mokocha, Joe Maxwell, Nkechi Nwabudike, Sheunu Rontimine, Kwajo Amankwa, Douglas Harder and Sherry Robinson, Craig Bolton, Samuel Badeau, Ghassan Virgiani, Ni T, Kitty, Tariq Biedelman, Kelvin J. Norris, and Ellen Fisher, among others. Thank you all for supporting the show. It really, really, really means a lot.